Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. The inner workings of intelligence gathering agencies has long been a sort of black box to the American public. How many are there? How do they cooperate and function? How have they changed? And what reforms are needed? Glenn Carl served 23 years in the clandestine services of the Central Intelligence Agency, working four continents and in Washington, D.C. His last position was as Deputy National Intelligence Officer for Transnational Threats on the National Intelligence Council, where he was responsible for strategic analysis of terrorism, international organized crime, and narcotics. His book, The Interrogator, explores doubt that he faced with his most serious assignment, where he interrogated who was thought to be one of the most senior al-Qaeda detainees. You were with the agency 23 years. Maybe a good place to start would be how you experienced the agency change over those 23 years.
Oh, dramatically. Not too long after I retired in 2007, I was on a panel. And the first question, it was a woman, a junior officer, and she said, "Mr. Carl, what was the single biggest change you noticed in the CIA from the beginning to the end of your career?" No question in my mind, and that is the changed role of women. When I started in the mid-80s, early mid-80s, in the Directorate of Operations, there were a few, very few, senior females, and they had to be really, really tough because they would have been steamrolled. There were junior officer females, peers of mine at that time, just starting. And otherwise, to put it somewhat crudely, but not too inaccurately, women were viewed as a support staff or there for the pleasure of the men who did the real work.
What else did you see change? Did it grow? Did it shrink? Did the focus move?
Oh, many times the focus changed. I mean, of course, the agency will reflect broader changes in the society. So also, when I first started, if one were homosexual, one would be fired or prosecuted. And then midpoint in my career, the laws changed and the regulations, I think because of President Clinton. And now to be gay is irrelevant and routine. So the agency's changed sociologically that way too. There are types of intelligence work that become the in thing and they rise and fall over time. So the paramilitary work of the CIA was very important when I first began in the mid-80s, and that's because of two things, largely. The efforts to defeat the Soviets in Afghanistan and the war with the Sandinistas and the Contras. And so those were in subjects, and there was a huge focus then on paramilitary Special Activities Division work. When the Cold War and those wars ended or petered out, then the paramilitary activities were no longer in vogue and the resources were redirected towards the traditional work of the agency again, which is human intelligence collection.
When you say human, you mean on particular individuals?
Convincing individuals to spy for the United States. So I would approach an individual and say, "Have I got a deal for you?" That's the heart and soul of the CIA's job. Special activities, paramilitary work, those are sexy things.
And the paramilitary work, you mean recruiting the paramilitaries to work on behalf of?
No, not necessarily. People who are highly trained, very impressive professionals in military skills. So if we are supporting the Mujahideen in their war against Afghanistan, the fact that I studied Thucydides in French is not directly relevant to the task. But if you're a special operations veteran, your skills are directly relevant to helping our allies in their effort against the Soviets. So that's paramilitary work. There are other things, too. When the Berlin Wall fell and the Cold War ended, then the central mission, historically, of the CIA ended, which was the Soviets. And we had to redirect again. And for a time, there was a debate, a search for, well, what is our raison d'etre? What's the mission now? And so is it economic intelligence? Is it political intelligence? What? George Tenet in the mid-90s, I think, saved the Directorate of Operations by reinvigorating and focusing resources once again on human intelligence collection. 6 years later, in 2001, of course, 9/11 occurred, and once again, paramilitary work as relevant to counterterrorism operations became the prime focus of where people wanted to go because you always want to be the pointy end of the spear.
How did changes in the administration affect the CIA?
It's tremendously influential. The
Give us some examples. You were there 23 years. That's a long time.
Well, yes, unfortunately. Or fortunately. When I started my career, Bill Casey was the director, and he was a veteran of the OSS in World War II. So for him, bureaucracy and the rules were hindrances and irritations, and he found the agency culture to get in his way.
Because the agency
followed the rules and had procedures, and part of the rules are to obey the laws. And he was mission-oriented, one could say, and he wanted to get the Sandinistas. And don't be a hidebound bureaucrat for me when I'm telling you that that's the mission. Arguably, that attitude led to Iran-Contra. When the directors changed, so did the culture. John Deutsch was focused on technical intelligence. He thought that satellites were important. And, of course, everyone, these are all shades of degree. But he also thought that human intelligence was slow, outdated, and done very poorly by the CIA. So he was open in his denigration of the Directorate of Operations and Human Intelligence Collection, which was the historic core of CIA's mission and heart of its culture. So he was not highly regarded by many of his subordinates. And then it changed again. So the director is critical, very influential in our attitudes, as is presidential administration.
Because the presidential administration would appoint the director.
In part because of that, but also because of the administration's focus and the issues to which it will have to respond. So George Bush II was obviously seized with 9/11 and counterterrorism, and that became the central activity of the Central Intelligence Agency and the administration for the 8 years of the Bush administration. The administration would argue that that was a response to necessity. One could argue otherwise, that it was a choice. But whatever the answer to that issue, the fact is that the agency follows the guidance and does the bidding of the executive, and the executive wanted counterterrorism as a priority, and so that's what it was.
In terms of the other intelligence agencies, is there a relationship, and how does it work, if so?
To answer that would be the work of multiple books. The relations are intimate, ongoing, 25 hours a day, all the time, among all the now 17 agencies of the intelligence community.
17,
right.
Can you name some of them?
Oh, sure. Well, there's the CIA, everyone knows about. There's the National Security Agency, which does electronic intelligence, picking up radio conversations and so on. There's the National Geospatial Agency that does satellite observation. There is the Bureau of Intelligence and Research in the Department of State that does analysis. There's the Defense Intelligence Agency that is a military copy of the Central Intelligence Agency, which was explicitly created by Robert McNamara so that the Secretary of Defense would not have to be beholden to an agency not under his control, and that has continued. One could argue that there is a lot of redundancy, but the counterargument is that different opinions working on the same issue provide perspectives that are complementary. Then there's Marine Corps Intelligence Agency and the Department of Homeland Security, the FBI, and so on. The core intelligence agencies are CIA, DIA, NSA, INR, Defense Intelligence Agency, State Department Intelligence and Research. So they're huge, and they work together in an infinite number of ways all the time. They do operations together overseas. They do analysis together or as constructive rivals on any issue.
Then say the CIA was working on an issue, say, in Afghanistan. You also have Army intelligence there. Do you have FBI there also?
The FBI is overseas in many countries, so it's quite possible they would be there, yes. Let me give a concrete example. Let's say the president wants to know what's happening in Waziristan, the ungoverned border area between Pakistan and Afghanistan. The question would go to the National Intelligence Council, where I was the Deputy National Intelligence Officer for terrorism, essentially. And I would call together to chair a meeting of the intelligence community. Each of the 17 agencies would send a representative, and I would say, the president has asked us to assess what's going on in Waziristan. And I would then dole out or coordinate how the responses would be prepared. I'd say, I need your respective assessments in 3 days. And they would send them to me, and then we would hash out. I would put it together in some sort of a coherent structure, and then we would hash it out. And I would say, okay, NSA says there's nothing happening, and CIA says that they have 400 nuclear weapons there. What's the truth? How do we answer? What do we do? And you hash it out. So you work together analytically all the time. Also, my experiences are typical. That's why the examples are useful. I was an operations officer for most of my career, meaning that I conducted operations to penetrate terrorist organizations overseas. And I worked intimately with the FBI on any number of cases. And I worked with the military on cases. And they brought their operational perspectives and expertise, as I did as a CIA officer, together to say, well, you know, I can pick the lock here, or I know how to speak that language, and we'll do this thing together.
You mentioned earlier about the Iran-Contra scandal, and there were quite a few convictions in that. And you've also described in your book this sort of gray, having to choose between unethical and unethical, essentially, or borderline ethical. And I wonder, when you look at Iran-Contra, can you put that into a context of the kind of gray area that you found yourself working in?
Oh, I can directly and firsthand, because it is a precursor experientially for me and should have been for the agency and our government of what I lived in the global war on terror. The gray area, well, I'll give an example. One of my superiors when I was working on Iran, I never worked in Iran, on Contra Sandinista issues, was sent to Central America. And the Boland Amendment had made it illegal for the United States, therefore the CIA, to provide lethal aid to the Contras. Well, that's the law. His job was to work with the Contras in circumstances in which the men with whom he worked were going off into combat routinely. And he was forbidden to arm them, but his orders were to have them conduct these missions. So that was a dilemma for him, because he didn't really want to send people unarmed, most likely to their deaths. And he had to decide what to do. And what he chose to do, unbeknownst to anyone else, was he provided them lethal aid. And that came out, and he was charged. And as I recall in testimony, the senator asked him, sir, are you aware of the Boland Amendment that outlawed that? And he said, yes, sir, I am. Did you provide lethal aid, sir? And he said, yes, sir, I did. And he said, how can you explain having knowingly broken the law, given your oath? And he said, sir, I don't know what things are like where you come from, but where I come from, you don't send people off to their deaths without giving them at least a chance to defend themselves. And I think one can only sympathize with the dilemma that he confronted, and he chose a path that was illegal. But he was in a terrible dilemma, and arguably you could say it was a clear issue that he can't break the law, but I think it was a gray moral crisis where no choice was the right one for him.
How often is that before you or your colleagues?
Something as stark as that, a life and death situation of war and clear legal obligations that one breaks, is rare. And that's an extreme example. I knew that man well. He's a fine man. More typical is a morally gray issue where your job is to get someone to commit treason. And to do that, you have to play upon that individual's deepest hopes and win his deepest trust, or hers, and then use that trust to serve the ends of the United States, which are not necessarily good for the individual, but that is the job. So there is a constant tension between the need to manipulate to accomplish your mission and your effort, which will be sincere also, to be of good faith to the man whose trust you are winning.
You said that you had to break laws, steal, lie about almost everything, and exploit people to do your job.
That's the job. I was going to say a paradox, but it is an exceptional challenge, morally, intellectually, and psychologically, to win someone's trust sincerely. And to do the job right, you really have to. People see through falsity more often than one would imagine. So you do want to be a good friend to this person, the angel of his hopes. And
that had to create cognitive dissonance.
For many, I think it does, and many officers, well, few people suited psychologically to do the job, and the agency does a good job of sifting, and then people early in their career will sift themselves, because it is a strange series of paradoxes that one lives all the time. Those who can work out how to compartment your simultaneously shared but contradictory emotions and moral obligations become good officers, and those who don't will leave. But dissonance, I don't know if I felt cognitive dissonance. I became good and at ease psychologically with my job, but it took a while to learn, because also paradoxically, but sensibly, the agency seeks to hire people of high moral rectitude who are deeply principled. And that is a contradiction with the obligation to manipulate others' deepest principles in a Machiavellian way, but that's the job.
So how many officers are there at a time in the CIA operating like this?
Well, that I can't say. That's a classified number. But I think I can say the general public will imagine that the CIA is everywhere. And certainly foreigners imagine that every time a traffic light goes out in La Paz, Bolivia, that it's the dark hand of the CIA is behind it. And we would always joke and think, well, if only, if only. In fact, the CIA is shockingly small, or the Directorate of Operations, shockingly small. People, I don't think, would believe how few of us there are. And it's typically our errors are those events that are discussed. But I think the agency and its personnel do, on the whole, remarkable work, given the resources that are spread really pretty thin.
There's a section in your book where you're describing what you went through, particularly with regards to this person who was the suspected high-level al-Qaeda person. And you said some call it torture, but you didn't yourself call it torture in the book.
Did I not? Maybe I didn't.
Do you consider it torture?
The simple answer is yes. Certainly the Bush administration and the agency worked hard to muddy the waters on that. And it is true that no one in the agency acted without direct authorization. I'm confident of that. And the authorization came from the president. And we were told that the president had consulted with the Department of Justice to verify that all actions that were ordered and authorized were illegal. And the agency was explicit, people above me, the senior levels of the agency, that it received clear legal guidance and authorization before doing anything. All of that is true. It's also true, however, that the guidance received was a hackwork bit of political flimflammery written by a political appointee that had nothing to do with 800 years of Western history and 250 years of American history, that didn't even make a mockery. It simply destroyed a habeas corpus, trial by jury, rules of evidence, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, the Convention Against Torture, the Geneva Conventions, the Executive Order 12333, which guides CIA officers' operations, and it was clearly in contradiction with them all. So was it legal or illegal? One can argue, if one is a casuist, that it is both. You know, morally, the spirit of our laws and the clear laws and regulations we had, the actions that we engaged in are, at the very least, unacceptable.
It seems to me that you wrote this book partly because of that experience seeming wrong to you and the administration's particular directive.
Oh, you don't need any qualifiers whatsoever. I wrote the book because I was terribly distressed, shocked, but sincerely shocked. I'm not the Casablanca pretense here, and deeply, deeply concerned as an American citizen that I was one of the few people who has firsthand knowledge and experience in what we did to ourselves and how gravely and egregiously we undermined and contravened the principles, regulations, practices, spirit, and letter of our laws and our society. And if I didn't write about this, I would then be a tacit cover-upper, and I wouldn't do it. That this, to me, what we did and what we have done to ourselves is as grave a crisis with as deep an impact on American laws, institutions, and society as anything that the United States has done since the internment of 110,000 Japanese Americans because their eyes slant only, that's the only reason, or since My Lai, or since McCarthyism.
Do you think most of your colleagues are on the same page as you?
I think most of my colleagues were profoundly disturbed about the impossible choices and dilemmas in which the CIA and its officers were placed. And there is always a bell curve of response to any specific action or circumstance. But generally, overall, the bell curve, all but maybe one or two standard deviations on the extreme, shared deep concern about what we were doing and what we did to ourselves. And our job is to do the hard tasks that are unclear as to whether they work or are right, but are ordered and we are assured are legal and in the national interest.
So in the 23 years you were with the agency, was this the first time that you felt this level of disturbance?
Oh, certainly. As I said, I worked on the Contra Sandinista war. I worked on the kidnapping of American officials, the CIA chief, and American civilians in Lebanon. I did counterterrorism work. I recruited people to commit treason. That was my day-to-day job for 23 years. There was nothing remotely as disturbing or that has raised as grave issues about American society and our government as the enhanced interrogation program and the misperceptions and delusions of the war on terror. Nothing remotely like it.
And where does the line get crossed? How does it get from this is okay to this is awful?
The agency and its officers take our oaths really very, very seriously, to the point of sacrificing or devoting our lives to it. And the oath is to preserve and protect the Constitution of the United States, uphold its laws, and serve the national interest. And the national interest can be ruthless, but it can never be to traduce the values and the laws that we are sworn to protect and the interests we are sworn to advance. And so when you have clear laws, the Convention Against Torture, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and you have all the checks and balances of our General Counsel's office in every sub-bureau of the agency and the government and the Department of Justice and the General Counsel's office and the Director of the CIA's office and in the White House, and you have oversight committees and on, and you have all of these measures to guide and make sure that our practices and actions are acceptable and serve the national interest, and all of them fail because of the work of or the actions of about a half dozen people, so that our laws no longer protect us, and our regulations and oversight practices no longer protect us, and our officers take actions that undermine the Constitution and habeas corpus and don't protect us. This is terrifying, because our government is then no longer a government of laws. And to say it sounds crazy, that doesn't happen in America, but it did. I lived it. And that is very frightening. And then even worse is that not only did it happen, but it happened with the broad, although innocent and ignorant, support of the American people, who had been told, we are protecting you, we are doing things that are necessary, it's okay. And the people said, well, okay, that's right. And that's right then accepted practices that undermined our laws. And that is really shocking.
You retired before President Obama took office, but I imagine you still have a sense of if things have changed back.
Well, I know that they changed quite a bit back. Well, I know John Brennan well, and I think very highly of him. He has a quite sophisticated view of the nature of the terrorist threat and a sophisticated and deep understanding of and commitment to our laws in spirit and practice and letter. And I know for a fact the paradigm that shapes our sense of the nature of the terrorist threat and the actions that we can take to counter it is radically different now than it was under the previous administration.
Two last questions. One is, now with your background and understanding through all these administrations and all of the questioning that you've done internally, what is your sense of Guantanamo Bay and what should be done about that?
Guantanamo is a blight on our society. Candidate Obama was right to say that that was the case and that he would close it. It is more than lamentable that because of political pressure and some practical considerations, to be fair, but for political pressure, he's been unable to close it.
Political pressure being what?
Well, the Republicans have come up with any number of arguments saying that we can't bring detainees onto American soil. It's too dangerous. I just find that would be laughable were it not so outrageous.
What about the agency itself? What is it saying?
Well, most parts of the national security establishment, most agencies, have wished to and sought to close Guantanamo, I would say, for years and years and years. The practical problems to which I alluded, however, are there are some detainees who will be tortured if they are returned to their countries of origin. By law and morally, we cannot do that. And the Bush administration struggled with this problem, too, and so it wouldn't send them back. Cannot. The administrations have been unable to bring these people to American soil for trial. So what do you do with them if Republicans make it impossible to bring them to the soil for detention or trial? We can't try some of them because the evidence that would be used was obtained either by measures that are arguably illegal or obtained through intelligence sources and methods, which, if revealed, would endanger the lives of our sources and our practices. So we're stuck, and no one has been able to figure out what to do. But it is a blight, because habeas corpus, I would argue, if one had to choose one practice in Western civilization that is the triumph and foundation of our freedoms, it is habeas corpus, and it is not just made a mockery, it does not exist.
Last thing I want to close with your experience, especially your last few years, if you were going to propose reforms to particularly the CIA, but also into the intelligence world, maybe they're political because of what you were facing from the top levels, what would you propose?
Well, this is one of the distressing points and conclusions that I come to, and I'm afraid I dismay, if not dishearten, people that ask me this issue when it comes up, because the terrifying, frankly terrifying, reality discovery that I made, among many, as I was involved in the war on terror and specifically interrogating this individual about whom I write, is that the laws are in place. We have many laws against torture and how to follow certain procedures to obey the laws as officials in the executive branch. Oversight does exist. Legal staffs know their obligations. Officers take an oath and know our obligations. We don't need more laws. We don't need more regulation. None of it sufficed to stop a half dozen or 10 dedicated, purposeful men from overthrowing all the efforts of thousands of good people over hundreds of years. It didn't suffice. It was very easy. So laws don't answer the problem. And I think the only thing one can do is to bear witness and shed light. And light and knowledge of practices make it harder to do wrong. I think that's the only thing that we didn't do that we could do, because all the other measures had been put in place and were there to protect us, and they failed.
You were clearly disturbed about this. Did you and your colleagues discuss it amongst yourselves, and did you have a sense that others were equally disturbed?
Oh, I knew that many were disturbed, but I will say during the time I was involved in the interrogation of this individual and was running it or part of it, the work pace is so intense that one doesn't have sessions in which one mulls over issues like this. And also, you receive your orders, and you have to try to do them as best as you can. And you don't argue with your subordinates, gee, you know, I think there's a morally ambiguous position here. And you don't say to your superiors that, really, although you are encouraged and expected to bring your judgment to issues at all times, nonetheless, you have to get on with the job. So there wasn't a lot of hand-wringing discussion during that phase. At headquarters, for years, however, many of us openly discussed the contradictions of our orders from our obligations and what to do about it. And it was, frankly, a frightening time, because to challenge authority led to professional and personal destruction. That's Orwellian.
Our guest is Glenn Carle, and the book he has written is The Interrogator, An Education. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.